Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and my guest today is Howie Hawkins and Steve Greenfield. And Howie is here to talk about the presidential election that's in process now. So, Howie, how's it going?
It's going good. I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
Great. So, you know, there's like 20 candidates. What is your feeling? What's your opinion for the candidates that are running on the Democratic line?
Well, how many are there now? 26? I mean, there's a lot of people to discuss.
I know.
Right. You know, my basic concern is that there's some talk on the left wing of the range of candidates about Medicare for All and a Green New Deal, but I have no faith that they're going to be able to follow through with that. You know, in Congress, for example, with the Green New Deal, which was the Green Party signature program for the last decade, they took the brand but diluted the content. For example, they extended the deadline for 100% clean energy and greenhouse gas reductions from 2030 to 2050. They cut out the demand to ban fracking and all new fossil fuel infrastructure. And they don't talk about cutting the military budget to put that money into the Green New Deal. So that's huge. But even with that, Pelosi won't let it be voted on in the House. And when McConnell let it be voted on in the Senate, all the Democrats either voted present or against it. So, you know, they're going to talk some stuff, but the question is, do they really mean it?
So right now, Biden seems to be the front runner. From your perspective, what's your view of Joe Biden?
Well, he helped get my pension cut. You know, he strong-armed members of Congress late in the Obama administration to change the Employment Retirement Income Security Act so that multi-employer pension funds, which I'm a member of one in the Teamsters, they could reduce our earned benefits because the funds were in trouble. And ERISA, that law I referred to, used to protect us. And this was added to the omnibus spending bill at the end of 2014. The Democratic sponsor in the House was a founder of the Progressive Caucus. And, of course, the Republicans were all with that, too. And so it was attached to the omnibus spending bill at the end of 2014. And, you know, my pension was cut 20% before I retired. So, you know, Joe Biden is not high on my list, and I don't think he's a friend of working people.
You know, people, I spoke to a pretty influential Democrat in New York City, and I said, well, who are you supporting for president? And he said, I'm supporting Biden because I want to win. So most people... Most Democrats, I believe, are not really focusing on the issue, but just the fact that Joe Biden's been around a while, they think he's a good guy, and they think he can win. How do you make people realize that there's issues involved?
Well, there are issues involved. Yeah, I mean, if you go from Trump to a, you know, corporate Democrat, it'll be, I would say, a lesser evil, because that corporate Democrat probably won't be, you know, doing racist dog whistles all the time and inciting white nationalist terrorists to violence against people of color, Jews, Muslims, and immigrants. So, but we can take care of Trump way before 2020 by impeaching him. An impeachment inquiry should be open right now. I mean, this guy, his abuses of power are unprecedented, and he's got a 40-year rap sheet of corporate and personal crimes that just make him unqualified to be sitting there in the presidency. So we should impeach him and let him go face indictments on some of those crimes. That's how to take care of Trump. Don't wait till 2020. Take care of him now. That's what I tell Democrats. You know, stop picking on the Greens. Go get your Democrats to impeach Trump.
I saw Howard Stern the other night. I saw an interview with Anderson Cooper. He interviewed Howard Stern, and Howard Stern just wrote a new book. And Howard Stern said that that Trump did this as a publicity stunt. He wanted to get his ratings up on NBC. He wanted higher wages for The Apprentice. And it backfired, and he became president. And he really dislikes being president. So if he dislikes being president so much, why is he reaching out for a second term? And if impeachment is on the table, isn't he afraid of what might happen to him?
Well, he's afraid of what might happen to him if he's not president, because you can't indict a sitting president for crimes like that payment to the porn star Stormy Daniels, in which the indictment, which got Michael Cohen his lawyer, names him as a co-conspirator. They give a name that's a euphemism for, but everybody knows it's Donald Trump. That's just one of many crimes he will face if he leaves the presidency. So his idea is the presidency is protecting him from prosecution, and some of those crime statutes of limitations will run out. So now that I think Howard Stern is pretty much right. Trump really didn't think he was going to win. It was about raising his brand, and he won, and now it's protecting him from prosecution.
So there's 20-plus Democrats in the race. Do you think any of them are talking intelligently that could solve the problems and help the average person in America?
Well, I think there are reforms that particularly Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are putting forward that are, you know, worth fighting for. They would improve, you know, conditions for people. The problem, I think, with their overall perspective is that they think this government can pass those reforms and they'll be accepted by the super rich and the giant corporations. But as long as economic power is concentrated in their hands, it translates into political power, which they use to block or roll back the kind of reforms that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are talking about. Look at the consumer, financial consumer board that Elizabeth Warren had a lot in doing in getting into the Frank Dodd reform of banking. It's been gutted by Trump, and that's exactly the way the banks want it. They were pushing to get it gutted anyway. So that's the problem if you don't change the system so we have economic democracy, so that people work in worker cooperatives or in public enterprises where that's appropriate, so that the wealth is spread and the net income of these enterprises goes to the workers in proportion to the labor they contribute, instead of them getting a fixed wage and all the net income or profit going to this tiny group of capitalists who get richer and richer.
I see many posts on Facebook. Intelligent, educated people, lawyers, teachers, etc., who are just mimicking the line of the Democrats or maybe even the Republicans. What in our society today? Why aren't people who have education thinking for themselves and speaking up for themselves on what's going on? Why do you think that is?
I think a lot of these people see the elected officials who they can go get an appointment and lobby as their peers who listen to them. And I think they're a bit deluded, because I think politicians listen more to their donors than to the voters. So I think they have more power than they really do. And, you know, why they don't get frustrated and break with the Democrats because, you know, what they advocate doesn't happen is a problem. But I think it's just because they feel they're, if they're, you know, you mentioned teachers and so forth, people well-educated, I think they think they have more influence than they really do. And so I think that's why they stick with the Democrats. Meanwhile, you know, working class people are so disgusted, they don't vote for either party. They stay home. You know, that's the largest group of people that abstain from voting. because they don't hear anybody talking about their concerns, and they don't trust the people that are in there to do anything about it because they've seen what's happened. And from their point of view, nothing has happened that will help them.
Yeah. Howie, I'd like to jump in here for a second and build on something that you just said there, because it came up in a conversation I've had with a couple of people over the course of this weekend. I don't know if you read or converse with Margaret Kimberly of the Black Agenda Report. She's also a Green. I like a phrase that she's been using. I know it's not original to her, which is about the liberal nonprofit industrial complex. It's a great term, but it covers an idea I've talked about quite frequently over the years, which is that the difference between resistance activity and lobbying is that lobbying has no end. We have been kind of inundated and inculcated over the years with the quote-unquote value of incrementalism. And what incrementalism really is about is that the lobbying institutions themselves and the nonprofits, which are principally fundraising organizations, on the grounds that they have some kind of access, if anything that they were targeting in their advocacy were ever actually solved in its entirety, they would all be unemployed. And so, you know, this notion of incrementalism and working through existing large slow-moving institutions is really kind of a nonprofit employment plan for lawyers and analysts and people with graduate degrees who are not really serving a productive function. You know, you watch TV and you see that those are exclusively the guests that are invited to mainstream media discussions. You never see people like you and me invited down there. You never see a Margaret Kimberly discussing any of these things from a truly alternative perspective, because incrementalism is profitable.
Well, and in order to get funded, what I've experienced is that the staffs of these organizations go to the Democrats and ask them, what are you willing to do? And then they come back and they tell their atomized base of followers and small donors what to do. And I just wrote a long piece for Counterpunch that was published last week on how that is happening right now in New York in the debate over climate legislation. There's a weaker bill called the Climate and Community Protection Act, and there's a stronger bill called the New York Off Fossil Fuels Act. And the weaker bill is supported by the nonprofit industrial complex. It's what the Democrats are willing to do. The New York Off bill, New York Off Fossil Fuels, came out of the movement to ban fracking and block these frack gas power plants and pipelines. And it is a much stronger bill, much better bill. So, you know, what I did was analyze why groups that, you know, the title was Why Doesn't the Climate Movement or Does the Climate Movement Believe What It Says? Because right in the Climate and Community Protection Act, it says the goal is to get to 450 parts per million carbon equivalents in the atmosphere, which was the climate science over a decade ago. Now it's 350 parts per million as a safety zone. And, you know, they're like saying, well, we can't get that because the Democrats aren't willing to go that far. But the science doesn't lie. So, you know, I think, you know, what you're talking about is a real problem. And it's why, you know, our social movements are so weak and having real impact, because we're dependent on these nonprofits, and the actual activists who rely on them for guidance and leadership are not talking to each other and thinking for themselves and deciding on their own strategies. And so, yeah, that's the big problem that we have, that we got to get people organized at the grassroots. And in New York, I, you know, we've done a pretty good job, I think, with the, you know, ban fracking and ban the fossil fuel infrastructure movement. A lot of strong groups. The win on the ban fracking was monumental. It's the only one we've got in this country. Well, maybe Vermont's added it, but they don't have much gas to frack anyway. But, you know, we were up against Wall Street and investors from China to Saudi Arabia, and we just created enough stink at the grassroots and didn't compromise our demands, so we finally won that. And that's what we got to do.
Now, if only that could have added on top of it a ban against importing fracked gas from elsewhere, then we'd really be getting somewhere.
Yeah, well, that's what we got to do in New York.
So, Howie, you're making an announcement tomorrow. So I'm honored that you're on Focus on Albany today. So tell everybody what you're going to be talking about tomorrow.
Well, I was working in the post office over Christmas holidays, 12-hour shifts. I even worked on Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. And meanwhile, a group of Greens around the country decided they were going to draft me to run for president, which I had not planned. But this group has really worked hard. They've put together a campaign. Now I'm retired. I don't go punch a clock every night at UPS. I got my Teamsters pension, even if Biden got a cut. So I don't really have a good excuse not to do this. So I've got my head around it, and we're going to announce tomorrow in Brooklyn at the Brooklyn Commons at 11 a.m. that I am seeking the Green Party nomination for president. And the central theme is an eco-socialist Green New Deal. We want to set the standard for the Green New Deal, not what the Democrats have put into Congress in a compromise form. We want to say we need system change to stop climate change. In other words, we can't rely on Exxon and the Koch brothers to reinvest their fossil fuel earnings in renewable energy. So we've got to have public ownership of key industries with democratic planning so we can make this transition to a clean energy system, which requires not only 100% clean power, electricity, but really redoing all the sectors of production. So the Green New Deal is really a green economy reconstruction program, for example, to rebuild manufacturing in this country. We don't have a machine tool industry, which is the core of all the productive sectors that produce intermediate and consumer goods. So we're talking about a Green New Deal factory in every congressional district. You know, the Pentagon puts military facilities in every congressional district to fortify its political support for its bloated budget. We're going to create a green industrial complex with clean, green manufacturing, organic agriculture, electrified rail transportation, a whole ecological reconstruction. That'll be the central theme of the policy that we're going to put forward. And the other major purpose of the campaign is to organize the Green Party stronger. So we got ballot access in New York, but this country's ballot access laws are the most obstructive of any electoral democracy in the world. And so we got to fight to get on the ballot in all 50 states in the District of Columbia. And then we're going to help green locals, green local chapters and local candidates organize their campaign. We'll provide organizers for them. And then we're going to try to build the base of the Green Party among the working class and youth and people of color who are voting in lower numbers. And that's the future of the Green Party. So that's what we'll be talking about tomorrow in Brooklyn. And then I'm going on a barnstorming tour through Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, Alabama, Missouri, and Ohio over the next 10 days, talking to Greens about this campaign.
Now, in 2000, the Democrats still blame Ralph Nader for Bush's victory. How do you overcome that? That's still the mindset of a lot of Democrats. How do you make them see, no, it wasn't Ralph Nader, and, you know, go with me and open your mind and listen to what I'm saying? I think that's really an important thing.
Yeah, it was the U.S. Supreme Court and then the Democrats not objecting to the Florida electoral vote in the Senate that enabled Bush to beat Gore, even though Gore actually won Florida when the major media went back and counted every ballot. And so, you know, Ralph should not be blamed for that. There is a problem in voting for president of the Electoral College, which distorts the popular vote. And the Democrats have lost two elections now, 2000 and 2016, when they had the popular vote but lost the Electoral College vote. And we have been giving the answer to that vote-splitting dilemma to the Democrats since 2000 with Ralph Nader, and that is we should have a national popular vote with ranked choice voting for president. And then you won't have that problem. And if the Greens are not in the election, it's not going to be raised. So that's another reason why the Greens need to run a ticket.
All right. Howie, let me just add one more thing to that, because I agree with that completely. But one of the things that I talked about when people raised that question in my case, I was in what was expected to be a closely contested congressional race between Democrats and Republicans last year. And I got a lot of angry, you know, contact from people over the course of my campaign on this subject. And what I said to them without any hesitation is that if you actually believe that minor party candidate speaking about non-defensive war, speaking about climate change and speaking about ending poverty is something that can take votes away from the candidate you're hoping will win, then you need to talk about that with your candidate, not with me. You know, because if those are things people really want to put their votes behind, that's something that your candidate is going to need to be calculating in terms of his own platform. And if he's choosing to ignore it, then he's making a choice that he thinks he can get more votes by ignoring it than by paying attention to it. And your complaint is with your own candidate, not with me. And I think that's something we need to talk about as well, too, because most of the critical issues that really affect the future of the people of this country are things that, you know, with full media participation, mainstream candidates simply never talk about. We have 40.1 million people in this country living below the poverty line. They have a 20-year lower life expectancy than the non-impoverished population, which is a phenomenal number. We're 55th from the top in infant mortality, and almost all of that is concentrated among those 40 million impoverished people. These are shocking and inexplicable things in a country that has a $20 trillion gross domestic product every year. And so I would just add to what you're saying, that if anybody out there in the general mainstream liberal community actually believes that vote subtraction is potentially possible when those issues get talked about, then they need to put pressure about that on their own candidates. You know, we saw how that was effective for Democrats, you know, in the Franklin Roosevelt administration when he got most of the ideas that we now consider the, you know, the 20th century social contract, the modern social contract of the United States was taken in whole from the platform of the Socialist Party that was gaining in votes every year. That's the other half of the conversation that we need to keep on having. It's like, if you're really worried about talk about these issues, then you'd better get your preferred candidates to start talking about them.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think another point we can make, in my congressional district, in the last 50 years, the only time a Democrat has beat the Republican, it's a fairly competitive district, is when a Green ran. And that's because the Green raised issues that the Democrat had to speak to instead of cozying up as far to the right as they could to get it, you know, going after Republican votes. And they sounded better to the whole population. And they won. The Greens improve races. We don't spoil them.
That's correct.
Now, the other issue, the other side of the coin is the media. You know, you watch the three networks, the three cable networks. You put the radio on. And no matter how good a Green articulates what's going on, the media will not cover them. How do you overcome that, Howie?
Well, we do overcome it to some extent. I think candidates and the Green Party needs to keep feeding journalists with good content on our positions, and good journalists know that we got something to say, and then they got to fight with their editors or their news directors, if it's a broadcast outlet, to get it covered. So that's an ongoing battle. But it is frustrating. I mean, just yesterday or this weekend, the Greens surged across Europe in the European Parliament elections. And I was reading Common Dreams, which is not corporate media. It's supposed to be progressive media. And when they went for comment on, you know, what that meant, they went to Bill McKibben, you know, who's known for 350.org. He's popularized that 350 target. But he's very hostile to the Green Party in this country. Instead of talking to a Green, they talk to him. I mean, that Counterpunch article, I took McKibben apart for that because he did a whole article in the New York Review of Books last summer about why he's still a Democrat after the Democrats went back to the all-of-the-above energy policy. The Democratic National Committee decided that. That was the one thing McKibben got as a Sanders delegate at the Democratic Platform Committee in 2016. And so he sort of had to explain himself. And, of course, all of the above is a euphemism for fracking the hell out of the country for oil and gas and subsidizing nuclear power plants that should be shut down before they melt down. That's where, you know, so for the, you know, Common Dreams to go to Bill McKibben instead of a spokesperson for the Green Party here is frustrating.
Steve, you're a
yes.
prolific writer on Facebook. What's your opinion?
Well, you know, it's a question, the age-old question that I've been asking all my life, going back to, you know, 1980 was my, I think this will probably register with Howie. 1980 was the first year I could vote for president. And despite the fact that Ronald Reagan was the Republican nominee that year, I considered everything on the balance, and I voted for Barry Commoner, an environmentalist professor from Queens College that was running for president. That's how I cast my first presidential vote. And I know that many of the people that were involved in the Commoner campaign in New York State went on to be the founders of the Green Party. You know, while I was still too young and doing other things to be aware that people a couple of years older than me were moving things in that direction. And of course, the question for somebody like Bill McKibben and anybody of that mindset is, why would you train your opposition against the people that are already most inclined to agree with the thing that you're trying to accomplish? Right? It is next to impossible to turn the Democratic Party around and make them acknowledge that 350 is an actual goal. But you will hardly find a Green anywhere that doesn't acknowledge not only that 350 is a worthy goal, but that maybe it's even a little conservative, you know, and how to move ourselves towards doing it and recognizing that we are in emergency status. What is the essential paradox, the internal contradictions of Democrats on these questions? Yes, I do spend a lot of time on social media, and that short video from Bill Nye, the science guy, that was actually made for one of the John Oliver broadcasts. It wasn't an independent thing. It's about 40 seconds long, about the earth being on fire and how you do spend money to extinguish fires. It was circulated by Democrats, you know, by the millions over and over and over again. But find me one that is willing to act upon that. You know, everyone thought it was a great message, but what is that disconnect between, you know, observing a great message and recognizing the science that underlies it, whether it's a climate change science, whether it's an economic science, whether it's a medical science, acknowledging that, and then saying, but the first thing we're going to do is squelch the voices and effectiveness of action of all the millions of people who already agree with us on this question. We're going to marginalize them. We're going to sideline them. That is, a version, a political version of Stockholm syndrome. You know, it goes beyond ordinary learned helplessness. When people actually raise their weapons and train them against the people that are the first people to step up and support what they're trying to accomplish, that's when we see the actual insidious, like, you know, mass psychological power. We look back at moments in history when it seems like entire societies shared a psychological pathology, right? Like the Germans in the 1930s and so many other instances throughout history. And we're seeing them now in all the countries that are making hard, you know, ethno-nationalist rightward turns once again with their own domestic politics, that there is something about human psychology that is susceptible to this kind of cognitive dissonance. So, you know, it's like we observe it all the time when we see people who watch Fox going out and casting votes that are clearly against their own interest. But we never discuss the examples of on a much wider scale where we see that amongst, educated liberals. You know, there's definitely a mass psychology issue underway. And I think what we need to do is, you know, you look at, say, the Jill Stein campaign from 2016 that got 1.5 million votes. And that was about 1 million votes more than she'd gotten only 4 years earlier. And so what we really need to do is see if we can find a way to take a good number of those 1.5 million voters and encourage them to make themselves publicly visible on the issues and not just quietly show up at ballot booths. We know that the trend is towards that number of people growing. The question for us now as activists is how to encourage those people to make themselves more visible on the issues in between election cycles.
So, Howie, I would really love, like, at your convenience, whenever it's good for you, to come on Focus on Mobility with Steve, because Steve is great. He's a good friend. And to talk about the issues and to talk about how it affects them, I think it's really important that people get another perspective instead of the crap that you see on cable news. So, Howie and Steve, would you be willing to do that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. You bet.
Great, great, great. So let's end it because I know, Howie, you have a busy day tomorrow. So you've been listening to Focus on Albany. You've been listening to Howie Hawkins and Steve Greenfield. So if you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes. If you have a comment about this show, hashtag Focus on Albany. Happy Memorial Day, guys, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a wonderful day. Bye.